Good evening. K2 Romeo India Whiskey here with K2 KEY. As the sound is begin the TechNet. TechNet number 1158 of the series that began way back in 1982. Person signs in for TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes. That means you have a question or a comment for the net. Main purpose of the TechNet, of course, is to get people's questions answered, discuss things of interest to ham radio operators. So give me your call letters and names at this time. K2RIW listening.
K2RXB.
I think it's Kilo Charlie 2 Romeo X-Ray Victor. What is your name, sir? And should I put you on the list for having a question or a comment?
My name is Ben. I'm only listening. I enjoy listening every Sunday. Thank you, sir.
Very fine, Ben. Anyone else to check in? Please give me a call, letter, and name.
Hey, good evening. WB2QGZ, Bill, with a question.
Very fine, Bill, with a yes. And one of these days, you and I are going to have an eyeball. Anyone else to check in? Please give me a call, letter, and name. Go ahead.
Yeah, good evening, everyone. This is KEY.
Okay, Mel checked in. We'll assume Mel will have something to discuss. Questions answered in mailbag. One more call. Anyone else have a question or a comment they'd like to make? Please give us your call letters and name right now.
KC2QFJ, Stephen and Michelle.
Okay, we got you, Stephen. More than enough to get going. Bill, looks like we got a slightly light night so far. Light night so far. Secure and sweet time. If you got more than one question, give them both to us, Bill. Mr. QGZ, what's the best phonetics you've ever thought of for those call letters? K2RIW listening.
Yeah. It's rough, man. It's a tongue twister. It's worse than CW. So, here's my question tonight. It turned up a little bit ago, a Kenpro Yaesu G400 rotor. And was up at what Horse Traders turned into called Nearfest last weekend or weekend before. And I turned up a controller for it. So, started fooling with the rotor. Had some corroded hardware that was stuck in there. I had to drill out some of these bolts and do some other mechanical work just to get it capable of holding the mast. I got that done today. And was fooling with the controller a little bit. And in my disassembly, this thing had actually, a lot of corrosion in there. Most of it I cleaned up, got nice again. But there's two ball bearing trays in there. And they had some kind of a black sort of grease on them. And I was just wondering if anybody had any experience with what to try to grease that up with. I guess my thought was to clean that all out and purge what's in there off the bearings and everything so I wasn't mixing two types. And it looks like the consensus seems to be poking around online. We're interested in a lubricant plate, like a moly disulfide grease. Just wondering if anybody had any suggestions for a specific brand or place to get it or something that's worked for them in the past. Go ahead.
W2PNJ.
W2PNJ. I bet Bob knows what to do. Go ahead, Bob.
It's probably black because of the aluminum oxide. I would recommend for low temperature capability you go to Granger and you get the silicone grease. They have all types of, if you can get, go online and look on that catalog and you'll be able to get a grease that'll handle, you know, the normal temperature ranges we have and down, below freezing temperatures. This way it'll stay viscous to you. W2PNJ.
You also give them a grease number.
Okay. Bob, let me ask you an opinion on this one. In the past, I've used automobile wheel bearing grease. Yes, the stuff is a bit more thick. However, I never worried about the thickness of the grease or how stiff it gets in the wintertime.
because I discovered that every time my rotator ever had difficulty rotating, was slow to move, it almost always was the electrolytic capacitor, the 120 microfarad capacitor, in a case of a Cornell Duvalier rotator. That capacitor, when it starts drying out, it goes from 120 microfarads down to 2 microfarads, you get no torque out of the motor. Whereas you put a real run-start motor capacitor in there, 120 volts AC, even though it's only running on 35 volts AC, all of a sudden your rotator has got more torque and you know what to do with. And as such, the grease being thick enough is more important than trying to make it thin. So I use wheel bearing grease. You might have an opinion on that one, Bob. I've done it for years, and I seem to have gotten away with it. But I guess you're saying the silicon grease, which maybe dries out more slowly, could be better. W2PNJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, good evening, guys. I checked in late, I'm sorry. It's good. I mean, we use them in our cars, and, you know, we run all kinds of temperature in the cars. But I would want to know the, because they call that, I think, NLG number 2, the your wheel bearing grease, or the grease they used to put in the grease fittings when we had cars with grease fittings, which is more commonly available. But I worked for a company, RAMCOR, Radar Measurements Corporation. We made waveguide switches, and we used silicone grease to lubricate the fairings with bifairings, remove the seals, flush them out, ultrasonic cleaning and some kind of a solvent, and we repacked the grease, the bearings, with silicone grease because they had to work at minus 55 degrees centigrade. So, I mean, when it comes to that, the guys in the trade, they call me the silicone kid because I have all kinds of lubricants, oils, and RTVs of various types. I love the product.
H-K-E-Y.
Mel recognized, and just before I turn it back to Mel, I think I'm going to take your advice. I'm going to be servicing both a Ham-M and a Yaesu G1000, I think it is. Therefore, do you have a model number for that grease? And I think you said you get it at Granger. What kind of a container? How many dollars? What model number? If you happen to know, Bob, W2PNJ, go right ahead.
I have a grease downstairs. It's I use it as a dielectric grease also in the lubricating. It's I forget if it's Loctite or the Dow Corning. But it's in a large toothpaste type of tube, you know. It's very easy to use, very convenient. The Granger book has a tremendous selection. They give you the temperature ranges and, you know, various uses. And they come, of course, in various sizes and prices. So the best bet is to check the Granger catalog.
Good advice, Bob. Now, Mel, you live in a pretty severe environment right by the seashore, or within a fraction of a mile of the seashore. And your guys have got rotators that they want to move reliability. And so what have you guys settled on, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, yeah, I got the grease, in fact, from Granger. The grease was, well, here's what happened. I ran into a couple of years ago, with the rotor. This guy, well, he still advertises in a couple of magazines. He rebuilds rotators. And in fact, I think he's got the factory service for High Gain and a couple others. I still see his advertisement here and there. He's got all the parts and everything. And I asked him about the greasing situation, and he gave me that time a number of Lubriplate to take. The white grease, white silicone grease made by Lubriplate. And I changed the rotor. In fact, you know, I just rebuilt the rotor again, a brand new rotor. Years old, and when the brake broke in there, I went through that last week. I remember mentioning that on a test project I had. I had to make a new brake for it. But the rotor I took down, I had overhauled. It's still good. It was an old Ham. It was Ham-M original. The Ham-M1 had been up there 20 years at least. And I don't know. I just felt that maybe it's time for change. You know, I took it apart. The doggone thing looked good. So I was amazed. And it had been lubricated with this Lubriplate grease. Low temperature. Yeah, it'll go down. Oh, I tested it. put it in a freezer. I took a blob of it and put it in the freezer originally. I remember trying it at the freezer temperature. Off and get down. The heck the freezer temperature went to. Went down as close to, the heck I wrote it down here someplace. I don't know where I wrote it down. But anyway, it took it down to minus 20.
That's what?
Minus 20 degrees. And it was good. I took it apart. Looked good. So I got a can of it. It came in a can. So I got a white grease. And I guess you put it on, just smear it on. Don't load it up in there. That's another thing he warned me. That he put a smear on the race and on the gears and all. Do not load it up. Do not pack it in, Dick. Over.
Give us a couple of words on that one, Mel. What happens if you pack it in? Is it going to go somewhere else that it shouldn't go? Go ahead.
Yes, possibly it migrates or whatever, but even the, mainly got the technical manual on from originally Heisen. Originally when Cornell Duvalier owned the company, CDE owned the company, and in the original manual, they give you step-by-step, you know, how the whole thing is taken apart and together, and all the parts and everything, lubricating, a whole section on lubrication and all. And it also specifies just a smear, Dick, over.
I'm amazed by that. In the early days of things like a prop pitch motor, when people wanted to turn a really large rotator and they weren't available, they went and got a prop pitch motor from, I guess it's a D29 or whatever that was sold on the surplus market. And they had like a 3,900-to-1 gear ratio in there, planetary gears, really great big sturdy bevel gears, and so Stucci stuff turned out a lot of foot pounds of torque, newton meters of torque, whatever set of units you'd like to use. However, the one thing that was not so reliable about those motors is that it was a brushed type DC motor. In other words, real carbon brushes with a commutator. And when the prop pitch motor was run in the horizontal mode, the grease stayed in the right spot. Well, we amateurs almost always run antenna rotators in the vertical mode. A smart person would mount a prop pitch motor upside down, so to speak. But the guy who does what he thinks is the conventional mounting ends up with the gears and the grease up high and the DC motor down low. And no matter how good that seal is, eventually oil, grease, and whatever migrates to the seal, comes down to the brushed motor, gets into the brushes and commutator, and makes a yucky mess, and it makes an unreliable motor that eventually stops. I'm telling my buddies who use prop pitch motors to rotate their whole antennas to do what the radio control model enthusiasts have started doing, and that is they use a so-called brushless DC motors, and they come with both external race and internal race. I think they call them outrunner and inrunner. And when you watch those radio control model airplanes fly with 3,000 watts of electrical power going to the motor. 30 some odd volts at 100 amperes is what's going to the motor. It's a brushless DC motor and turning out about 4 horsepower. The motor itself is about 3 inches in diameter and about 3 inches long. You know, a motor that small turning out 4 horsepower with modern day circuitry with extremely high reliability. Wow. Those guys have come a long way. So when it comes to the prime movers for our future antennas, keep those in the back of your mind. So it looks like we've got some good suggestions there on the grease stuff, Bill, and good luck with that rotator. Whatever you find. I've never used a Yaesu rotator. For years and years, I've used a Cornell Duvalier HAM-Ms, AR-22s, and whatever. The nice thing about the HAM-Ms is I know a lot about them. The not-so-good news is that unless you convert from the Don 8 screws of contacts, which rust over to the new real, what would you call it now, Andrew-like connector. Until you change over, the reliability of input connectors is not so good. And the indicator for what direction center is aimed. The ham ends are okay accuracy to the nearest 3 degrees or so, whereas the Sirius microwave operators have almost all flipped over to the Yaesu rotators, which I have the impression have much higher accuracy of the indicator. And so getting down to 1 degree into a fraction of a degree of aiming accuracy when you're using a 3 degree dish is something that's very handy. Just came back from a major microwave contest, conference that was on from Thursday until Saturday night. I'm still recovering from that one. I'll tell you guys a little bit about the next few transmissions. So, Bill, back to you for any further questions. WB2Q, she said, which probably stands for a quick, gorgeous zebra, K2RIW.
Yeah, we've bludgeoned two quiet goats zealously. Okay, well, all right, thanks, Vic. Thanks, Bob. I will grab my Granger catalog, which is on my desk at work, and go grease shopping on Monday, and we'll see what happens. Luckily, this is not mounted too far away from where I can get it or get at it kind of easily, and I'm really kind of rolling the dice here because it was in service for a while, the rotor portion itself. It was laying horizontally for a while, I think, in somebody's backyard. And, you know, I'm not sure what I'm going to get out of it here without a big, big rebuild, but it'll let me get a couple of directional antennas up here in a hurry. It happens to, I needed something for the 2-inch pipe that I have existing up there with this way I can get the directional antennas up without changing out the existing mast, so. We'll see what happens. If it gets through the winter, I'll, we'll see what happens in the spring. But this way there's a reasonable chance of me getting this stuff up before mid-November or so. So thanks again for everybody's suggestions, and if I find out anything interesting or have a specific model or see anything once I look over the Grease Island Grangers, why, I'll surface next week. WB2QGZ.
Yeah, good luck with that project, Bill. Come back and report to us how it goes, and is this the winter, or when is the right time to put up the tower in your backyard, Bill?
Hey, it sure is warm enough. I'm still walking around trying to find a spot that doesn't have plumbing or electrical service underneath it in the back. So, progress.
Yeah, okay. You can let that stop you, and I don't think you should. Declare the day. Chris, me, and other people will join you for an antenna raising party, and you supply a little bit of pizza, and up can go a lot of ethereal adornment, so give it some thought. Steve, Steven, KC2 QFJ, what would you like to talk about? K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick, and everyone on the net. Good to be able to participate in real time. I've been listening about a year on the recording, so thank you. Gentlemen, make those recordings available. Thanks to all you guys for sharing so much info. I'm kind of a newbie. I just upgraded to General in August and obtained a CS520 old rig to get on HF. My question is, with the tuning, I find that on 20 meters, once I tune up the rig, I can go from end to end of the band without retuning. But then when I'm down on 40 meters, if I go just about a third of the way up the band, then I have to reach in. I'm wondering if it's a problem with the radio or characteristics of the band. No basis for comparison.
Okay, I also own a Kenwood TS-520. And I think you're probably discussing the tuning and loading control on the plate circuit. I haven't used it in some time. And I don't think there's a tuning and loading control when it comes to the drive. Now, I think you're talking about the tuning and loading control of the plate circuit. What's really going on here, in my opinion, Steve, and maybe we'll have some other people to correct me if I'm wrong, is that when you and I are using an antenna, one of the best-kept secrets that the books don't make super clear is the antenna must resonate first before you can radiate. And when I say antenna, I should say antenna or radiating system. The radiating system consists of whatever you consider the antenna, dipole, yagi, quaggy, cubical quad, square loop, whatever, J-pole, ground plane, whatever you consider the antenna, combined with the transmission line combined with the antenna tuner if you're using one. For the Kenwood 520, yes, you usually don't need one. It's got a large tuning range. Combined with the tuning and loading controls of the plate, the pi tank circuit of your final tube, the 4CX 6146, I think is in that rig, one or two of them, I'm sorry, remember. So that whole combination must be resonated, and then you radiate. Depending on what you're using for an antenna, your 20-meter antenna could, by way of its construction, could be a relatively broadband antenna. Maybe it's a multi-band trap dipole, for instance, which happens to favor 20 meters and covers 20 meters with a rather small standing wave ratio across the band. By comparison, if your 40-meter antenna happens to be a more narrow-band antenna for whatever reason, and I can list a whole lot of reasons of how either by design or by mistake, your 40-meter antenna could become a narrow-band device, in which case every time you change frequency by 50 kilohertz, you have to readjust the tuning and loading control. Most likely it's not the TS-520. I am guessing most likely it is the antenna radiating system itself. When in doubt, you could confirm this by putting your TS-520 into a dummy load. Ain't nothing more broadband than a 50-ohm dummy load. And if you tune across the band, you don't have to retune the tuning and loading controls, but on your antenna you do, then that would be pretty strong evidence the antenna is what's creating the narrow bandness. And how does an antenna become narrow band? I'm about to write another article on that one, and that's a story. Boy, is that a story. So make sure I'm not going way off on a tangent here, Steve. Let me first print it back to you. KC2QFJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, thanks. It is a bit of a tangent, but only because I wasn't clear enough in my description. First of all, it's TS-520S. I am using a tuner, and I have a G5 as the junior. So I have an experiment with one on 8 meters. We don't have that capability, but it is the drive. It does have a drive tuning, and it's the drive tuning I'm talking about, because actually I don't have to re-dip the plate or load very much. But as I move up and down the 40 meter band, I do have to retune the drive control. So sorry for that, sending down around that, but that's the whole situation.
KF2L. Okay, RL recognized. Yep. Because I had something in front of that knob, I didn't see the drive tuning control on my Kenwood 520, which I'm looking at right now. As you can tell, I haven't used it for some time. Therefore, I'm not familiar with that. KF2RL, bring us up to speed here. What should we know, Steve?
Well, for a given Q, he should have half the bandwidth on 40 meters than he does on 20 meters. So, of course, it's going to be more narrow-banded.
Okay, back up a little bit. Tell me why you think driving a 6146 on 40 meters would have a higher Q than a 6146 on 20 meters. I'm going to make a quick guess. 6146 has a little bit more transit time loading on that tube at 20 meters, and for that matter, maybe it's going to have even more in 10. Therefore, it's the equivalent of a resistor inside the grid of the 6146. That resistor becomes a little bit lower as you go up in frequency. That's one mechanism by which the Q gets higher as you go down. Although, let me think about that. If he's running class AB1 drive, and I'm not sure if the rig does, I would guess the real equivalent resistor is a function of how much grid drive we're seeing here on the final tube. So give us a few more words there, Steve. KF2RL, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2RIW, KF2RL. No, what I'm saying is that on 40 meters, you should have half the bandwidth than he does on 20 meters for a given Q.
Okay. However, all righty. Another way of wording, I'm going to put a lot of extra words in your mouth here, Steve. Steve number two, this is, as opposed to Steve N. The percentage of bandwidth of 40 meters, I think you're telling me, is greater than the percentage of bandwidth of 20 meters. A fixed Q is a fixed percentage of bandwidth. That will say the 2-to-1 standing wave ratio points. So the hold-on band on 40 meters is around 300 kc wide. the whole non band at 20 meters is 350 KCY. So, yes, you have percentage-wise almost twice as much percentage of bandwidth on 40 meters. Is that what you're saying, Steve? Go ahead.
Yes, I am.
Okay. Now you and I are on the same page. All righty. So, therefore, I think you're saying there should be twice as much retuning requirement of the drive control as you tune across the band on 40 meters versus 20 meters, everything else being equal. We're always using the same amount of grid current of the tube and so on. So I think what we're saying here, Stephen, is that what you're experiencing is most likely normal conditions for that rig. As I think back now of a few years ago when I did use my 520, and you got the 520S, they're very similar. I think the major difference is one of us has got a built-in inverter, so we run at 12 volts as well as 110. But I do remember the rig does require a lot of fiddling with the controls as you change frequency. I think the manual doesn't make that clear, but as you talk to more and more people using that rig, I think you're going to get a confirmation. I think it does not represent an error. I think you're in good shape. You may be want to ask you more questions on this, Stephen. KC2QFJ, K2RIW.
Oh, yeah, thanks, guys, for that. That seems to make sense. I suspect that it might have been the percentage, but I didn't know. I was making a whole benchmark to compare it to how much was normal for now. That's normal. That's good. I'm glad to hear that. Maybe a little more discussion about exactly where the various capacities are turning on. The drive control, I guess, input to the driver 2, and then plate and load is what's shown on the block diagram as the PI network.
You've got it, Stephen. Between the pre-driver tube, the driver tube and the final tube, that's the so-called drive tuning, I believe. And some rigs, by the way, that is a ganged control, which is tuning up. In some cases, you take the driver tube. I'm gonna pick a number out of the air. Let's assume that your driver tube is a 5763 and your final is a 6146. On some rigs, the 5763 has a knob coming out to the front panel called drive. It could be called drive tuning, and it might be tuning the input network and the output network of the 5763 tube in my example. So sometimes it's multiple stages in the drive chain being tuned. That's the way it was done on the Heathkit HW100. And without a doubt, the plate and tuning control almost always are the plate and final PI network. The nice thing about a PI network is that a well-designed one can tolerate huge numbers, like 10-to-1 standing wave ratio of almost any phase angle, and it can tune it out. In other words, your antenna could look like a 15-ohm load or a 150-ohm load, and all kinds of capacitive, inductive, reactive. You promptly set those controls, and it smooths everything out. Many a tube rig like the 520 has such a wide tuning range that you almost do not need an antenna tuner. However, the G5RV, particularly on 10 meters, has a history where an antenna tuner is a good thing to use because its requirement for impedance matching on 10 meters is a little bit stronger than most other rigs. When you redraw a PI network, first of all, just draw a PI network. You got the tube on the left-hand side, the plate of the tube is on top of the tube, so to speak, the anode of the tube. A wire goes over to the C1 capacitor. That's the so-called tuning capacitor. It's usually something like 365 picofarad picocapacitor going from that circuit to ground. From that junction of tube and capacitor I just mentioned is the inductor. It's a horizontal coil. Goes over to capacitor number 2, which is the loading control, another capacitor to ground. And if I think about it more, that's the one that's 365 picofarad. The input one is something a little smaller, more like 100. That last junction to the right of the C2 capacitor goes to the antenna. That's the way the circuit is normally drawn. If you redraw the circuit a little bit, put the coil vertical, you'll suddenly recognize the two capacitors are in series with each other with grounded leads in the center of the two. Now when you look at it from that point of view, you suddenly realize that the C1 and C2 capacitors constitute a capacitor voltage divider network. And that gives you some idea of how resetting the C1 and C2 capacitor in the right combination will simultaneously give you the right amount of total capacitance that creates resonance, and the right ratio of the capacitance that gives whatever impedance match you want. So it's a really a magic circuit, very popular among tuba bridges. Now, for a whole bunch of reasons, guys have been hollering that they don't want to spend tuning and loading. They don't want to spend time doing tuning and loading. They also want to have a one-knob radio if possible. So the modern-day solid-state rig has no tuning and loading control, has no drive control, has nothing, so to speak. So now they put the onus on the owner to make sure that the antenna has an extremely low standing wave ratio, numbers like 1.7 to 1 and better. And then the solid-state rig is a little easier to use. You go to any frequency you want, you press the push-to-talk button, and you're on the air, as opposed to a rig like a 520. You got to do a little bit of fiddling. You either have a lookup table to rapidly get you the right settings when you change from one band to another during a contest, or you spend the time doing the tuning and loading. The good news of the solid-state rig is they're fast. The bad news, it's fast to get on the air and change frequency. The bad news is they're kind of persnickety. They really want high quality on the standing wave ratio of the antenna they connect to. The good news of the old tube rigs like your and my Kenwood 520, although they take a little longer to tune, they've got a lot more adaptability. You can load them into anything within reason, and it'll fly. So I'm with you, and I would hang on to that one a while. Even though it's a 1975 rig, approximately, I think it's an oldie but goodie. It's the Kenwood 520, in the mind of many serious HF operators, has one of the world's best noise blankers. So when you've got ignition noise and power line noise and whatever, and you turn in that noise blanker with the 520, the only receiver I know of that has a slightly better noise blanker was the Drake R4C receiver, again a tube-type receiver. Back to you, Stephen, for any other further comments. KC2, QFJ. And by the way, as you find out more about that rig and learn to love it, come back and tell us what you like and what you don't like. Over to you, Stephen, K2RIW.
K2KEY comment.
Okay, hang on there a minute, Mel. Stephen first, go ahead.
Great. I love the rig. I bought it, in late July, only for reasons of economics. Poverty, really, just because it's really $40,000 for a modern, brand new radio. And this is the first one I came across on Craigslist. Came with the tuner, and needed only minor for the electric mechanical repairs. I opened it up and took out the BFO tuning, got the bumps out of it, fixed some things. And the side effect of it is now I'm completely bitten with glow bug tuber and antique old tube and radio as well as test equipment, which brings me to another question I have when we come back to me later. But go ahead now.
Okay, now you did the right thing. When it comes to bang for the dollar, slightly older rigs, tube rigs, give you a lot more watts output performance per dollar, in my opinion. On top of that, you've chosen a rig that's got a darn good track record. There's a zillion people around that'll tell you how to get rid of any bug that yours ever developed, troubleshooting and whatever. So that's a good way to go. Mel, K2KEY, go right ahead.
Okay, this is K2KEY, yeah. I think I have one in the closet. The only pain in the neck with that is those plug-in circuit boards that they have vertically. The service that any one of those boards is a real pest because you don't have the extenders for those boards. Yeah, the Pi circuit really thick. The original description of it, I'll never forget, back in the 30s. The 40s, right after World War II, was because of the shunt-fed system to remove the DC voltage, the DC plate voltage from the coils and the capacitors. That was the original, I remember, the original description of the Pi network, over.
Yes, to him. Do you recognize? I've seen lately, particularly the one that the Rich Boy. My goodness, my brain is going blank today. Rich in Whitestone, would you believe I can't think of his cold can't think of his cold letters. Ridiculous. I've had a rough weekend, which I'm going to describe to you guys a little bit later. But he's got a rig, a pretty potent rig, where there's a coupling capacitor, doorknob-type capacitors on the tube going into the pipe, tank circuit. And so the B-plus is getting to the tube by way of an RF choke, and none of the RF B-plus voltage, in this case 3,300 volts, none of it's getting to his PI network because it's isolated with a capacitor right at the tube. That's a very sophisticated circuit, a very good way to go. Steve, KF2RL, go ahead.
Okay, I'm not sure about the 520, but I have an 830 over here, and it's actually got a drive and a plate. It doesn't actually have two capacitors on the output. It's got a capacitor to tune to the grid of the tube and, to the output of the antenna. So you don't have a full adjustment. That's all I wanted to say.
Okay, I'm looking at mine right now, and how can I be so wrong? I see the plate tuning. I see the drive tuning. You're telling me that you don't have both a tune and a load control on your 820? You're telling me you only have a so-called plate tuning control there? There's got to be a loading control. Back to you on that one, Steve.
Different rig.
Yeah, mine's an 830. I took the 520, 530 were the same, but one has a drive and a plate tuning, that's it.
Different rigs, Dick.
Yeah, I know they're different rigs, but I thought the plate tank circuit was very similar on those. Anyone have specific information by comparing the two?
Yes, I'll tell you. The 830 and the 520 are completely different.
That settles that. Even though they look somewhat similar, go ahead, Nell, and describe the difference.
Talking a lot of years different. The Kenwood 520 came out, boy, I think it was in the early 60s or so. Yeah, it was one of the early versions. And then the Kenwood 830, which he has, the PS830, was completely re-engineered. The whole thing was redesigned. They completely redid it, their cover.
Okay, is the 830 a tube final or a solid-state final, Mel?
There are 6146s driven by it. I think they have there were two versions. One uses a 6GK6 as the driver, and one used a 12HL7. I don't remember which was which, Dick, over.
WHCDL Mobile.
Go ahead, Andy. You've touched a lot of these rigs. Straighten us out.
I fixed many of them. In fact, I have an 830. It uses two 6146s driven by a 12BY7, just like the 820 and the 520 and so on. And mine has a plate, load, control, just regular PI network, just like the others. Mine is no different than the others. And it also has a drive control, which is also a ganged capacitor that is also used for the pre-selection for the receiver. Just like the 820 and the 520. No difference on mine anyway.
Okay, I'm going to tell you what I see on my front panel, and I'll bet you the 820, 832 version, if it is very similar. Far upper right-hand control is the drive control. The next knob over to the left is called plate control. It's got sections that are labeled for 3.5, 7, and 20 megacycles and so on. The third knob over to the left is the meter selection knob for the outer and the plate loading control for the inner. And below that knob is labeled load. So the confusion is below the knob is labeled load on the third knob to the left, and the second and first knob to the right, or to the left, so to speak, have the word plate and drive on top. So to have a PI network with a plate tuning control without a loading control, to me, sounds crazy. To make sure I haven't lost it completely, Andy, try to give me a confirmation on that. W2CDL, K2LIW.
You're right. I didn't see the other name.
All right. The mystery's clear. You almost sent me to the funny farm there, Steve. because at first you convinced me, I'm looking at my front panel, there is no loading control because there's no label on the top. And I'm saying to myself, how in the world? I mean, the whole idea of the Pi network is that it really is a capacitor divider network, which allows you to both resonate and get any impedance ratio of input-output impedance of the tube versus antenna, any ratio you want. And how in the world they could make that fly without the loading control? Wow, that would take magic, a servo mechanism. It would take a lot of sophistication. And boy, they'd be breaking a lot of history. So let me go back to the jury one more time. Does anybody know of a Pi network and any of these 10 wood rigs that does not have a loading control? Speak now or forever hold your peace. K2RIW.
If it didn't have a load control, it wouldn't be Pi. It would be an L or something else.
Amen. Give that man a cigar. Okay. I think that mystery is somewhat resolved. Okay. I know that Stephen said he had a second question. We've already gone through the list of people who have signed in so far. So, Stephen, hit us with your second question.
Okay. As I said, getting inside the 520 and seeing electronics that should actually work on it fits mainly the old-time equipment plug. And so I've been collecting some old test equipment, and I'm particularly fond of Genrat. Beautiful old stuff. Nutmeg, Sandfell, old Genrat, I think it's 857. It was the tuning mechanism for a laboratory oscillator that covered 100 megahertz to 500 megahertz. And it had a separate power supply, which I didn't get. And I opened the thing up, there was no tube in there. It used an old storm valve tube. But what's beautiful about this, besides the gear reduction tuning network, is it uses something called a butterfly tuning, which, according to the manual, tunes both the inductance and the capacitance, such a broad range without switching. So here I am without the tube, without the power supply. So what would I need to do to transistorize it and create some sort of bench oscillator?
Yeah, that's a project. First of all, the butterfly capacitor. An ordinary air-type variable capacitor has a bunch of stator plates which cover approximately 180 degree sweep, so to speak, when you look down the shaft. And your variable capacitor, your movable plates also cover roughly 180 degrees. So with a 180 degree turn of the knob, you go from maximum to minimum, or minimum to maximum, whichever you like. In the case of a butterfly capacitor, you've only got the stator plates, I'm going to say from the 1030 position to the 130 position. You've got one set of stator plates. You have another set of stator plates from the 430 position to the 730 position on the clock. And then the rotor plates are also only 45 degrees. You could say from 130 to 430, and from 730 to 1030 are the set of rotor plates. Therefore, in the case of a butterfly capacitor, you go from maximum capacitance to minimum capacitance with only a 90 degree rotation of the knob. It's a pure butterfly capacitor. The good news is that they have a much larger ratio of maximum to minimum capacitance, particularly if you use those stator plates in series. The rotor plates are usually grounded, but not always. So it's a beautiful mechanical mechanism. That tube that was inside of that General Radio 857 oscillator, I think is a so-called acorn tube. And I think it's a 955, but I'm not sure. The power supply, there's no great magic there, even though you're missing it. If you get the right schematic diagram, you find out that, I'm going to pick a number now, but it needs a plus 175 volts on the plate, and if it possibly needs a bias supply, maybe it's a minus 5 volt bias supply, but probably not. With modern-day solid-state circuitry, to duplicate the power supply, once you get the right transformer, so to speak, if you decide to build it that way, would be not too difficult. If you want to go one step more elaborate, make it a switching regulator, a switching type power supply, you could do a real fine job with it. to take the tube circuit and simply plug in a transistor is not going to be easy. You probably already know that, Steve. On the case of that Acorn tube, which I think was in there, I think it was a 955 Acorn tube. It's a very small tube with a grid and a plate and a cathode. It's a triode type tube. The grid has an extremely high input impedance. It almost never goes into grid conduction. And the plate's running on something like 150 volts, 175 volts, I'm guessing. But it's a reasonably high voltage. To find a transistor, a FET transistor that can run at such high voltages and have similar input and output capacitance is going to be difficult. Not impossible. Worth a try. Good engineering exercise. Solve the problem of matching the impedances and resonances and reactances so that the frequency dial comes out the same. It's doable with difficulty, and when you do succeed in doing it, it would make a beautiful final paper for the for your report in your senior year of a college engineering course in electrical engineering. And it would be a good paper that you could write up in QEX magazine. A number of people have their hands on an 857 general radio oscillator, and they keep them as antiques, so they buy them in flea markets and fall in love with them because they've been around for so long and once were so popular, and you come up with a technique of transistorizing it, and people will beat a path to your door. They'll be very excited about that article. So, great difficulty in doing it, but it is possible. Wonder if anyone's had any further comments on that particular subject. Give us your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2KEY.
Do you want to comment?
Okay, we've got both Mel and Andy in that order. And I know that when it comes to the tubes that are used in a Drake R4C receiver, because people fell in love with that receiver so sincerely, that there were manufacturers out there that made a solid-state equivalent for many of those tubes. You can unplug the tubes, which always needed changing in that receiver to keep it up to full performance, and you could buy solid-state direct form, fit, and function plug-in for solid-state devices that act like those tubes without receiver. Therefore, the possibility exists that somebody makes a solid-state equivalent. K2KEY, go ahead, Mel.
Actually, that's what I was going to say. This is K2KEY. There's a number of solid-state replacements directly plug-in. However, there was a couple of articles, well-written articles. If you, for instance, had one of the old grid dip meters that that used what tube like the heck did they use? Those grid dip meters, 6AF4. I don't remember. 6J6. I'm trying to remember the tube number of the. It was very popular, the number of the old grid dip meters. That how to take out the tube and convert the grid dip meter to a solid state. They could run it off a battery, and basically you want the same circuit, same idea, because they tell you how to rework the circuit, you know, using a replacement transistor. And what did they use? Yeah, they used an FET, right? And I think what they basically do to simplify the job, they use the 6.3 volt filament and now turn that into the low voltage rectifier for the transistorized version and just forget about the plate winding, Dick, over.
Very good. By the way, I think many a grid dip meter uses a 6C4, 6 Charlie 4, little triode tube. Is that the ring a bell, Mel?
Yeah, I think some of them use 6C4s, but I'm trying to remember the other two. I think it was a 6AF4. No, I don't know. They must have had a number of versions of a 6J6 maybe in some of them. I don't remember which one was what thing, really. But I know there was a number of versions of taking the old known tube-type grid dip meter, which was a very nice meter, you know, well-made, nice-looking, you know, case, heavy-duty case and everything was very popular, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, and turning into a solid-state version, and it just clipped the line cord off. No, you can put a battery in, but if you still want to use it off AC, the power supply, the transformer, they use the filament that the power supplies for the solid state version. But I think it was easy to take the transformer most likely out and stick a 9-volt battery in its place. Over.
6EW4, Novista. It's a Novista.
No, I don't think so. 6EW4 is the new Vista, and I've never seen a grid dip meter with that particular tube in it, Howie. Although I've used old-fashioned Heath kits and whatever. Maybe the more modern one used the new Vista. The new Vista tubes, these ceramic little bitty tubes, you know, it had a ceramic base to them with a bunch of pins coming out of it and a metal top on most of them. 16W4 is one of them that had it. The tubes were fantastic. The sockets were yuck. Really terrible. Talk to anybody with a new Vista network and you can ask them how many times you have to juggle the tubes in the socket so the socket would make contact. We hadn't learned our lesson yet when it comes to dissimilar metals. So the pins coming out of the tube and the metals in the socket, they were not gold-plated. I don't think they were silver-plated. I don't know what they were, but boy, did they give unreliability 6 months after you put it together. That's an opinion. Andy, WA2CDL, tell us your message, sir.
Correct, Dick. They did have a 16W4 version of the grid-dip meter.
Alrighty. I wasn't modern enough to have one of those. Andy, WA2CDL, go ahead.
Well, actually, that was Howard that made sounded like me for a second. But I was going to say the same thing. They did make a 6EW4. I have an ICO, an old ICO grid dip meter. And it uses a tube, but it's not a 6EW4. I really forget the number of it. Just wanted to make that comment.
I had a WB2HWW comment.
Go ahead, Howie.
I had a 6EW4 preamp on my 6-meter Clegg Venus. Man, what a tube that was. That was pretty good up to VHF. I never used it in UHF, but they used them in a lot in the CB rig. What a great little tube that was. Running about 150 volts or 100 volts, and the tube worked real well, Dick.
I think you said that was a Clegg Zeus, Clegg Interceptor. You owned one of those combinations, Howie? You must have been a pretty affluent guy at the time.
My old man, I had a Clegg Venus, I had a Clegg Zeus, and I had the Clegg Interceptor. And I also ran, at one time, an Apollo amplifier. Remember the Apollo amplifier?
Wow. Were you well equipped? Wow. In its day, these were the Cadillacs. That and the Collins rigs with a Cadillac. And good old Mr. Clegg, just very nice design. Mel, I'm going to hit you with a real trivia question here. You and I go back to the RCA 630 chassis, the RCA 10-inch, 12-inch, or television set, 1947 vintage. The tuner on that set contained a 6J6, which is a dual triode tube. I think, I'm not sure, but I believe there may have been a pair of 6J6s. One of the pairs was used as a Cascode RF amplifier, two tubes for the RF amplifier. And the other 6J6, I think, was used for oscillator and mixer. So am I right or am I wrong? Were there a pair of 6J6s inside of a metal shield on the tuner section of that rotary switch of an RCA 630 television set? Now back to you, Mel.
Okay, that's definitely two 6J6s. The third tube in the middle is 6AK5.
And Doug, go ahead and correct us on this. K2JJ, you got it.
Yeah, even Dick, Mel, everybody aboard. Just happened to pull up the manual here on that general radio oscillator. If the gentleman needed any particular information, I can give it to him. It's available on BAMA on the internet. Look that up. They use a Western Electric 316A as the oscillator, but power requirements of 2.5 volt filament at 3.7 amps, 350 volts on the plate at 50 mils.
Wow. 316A. I know what a 317 is. Not as familiar with the 316. 350 volts, 2.5 volts, 3.7 amps. Amps. For a low voltage oscillator, that lower current, that much current, that lower voltage. Boy, that's unusual. Now, you said he can look it up on the internet on BANR. from the words that I think I heard you say. Give us a couple of words as to where the full URL is on that one, Doug. What's the www.what is going to give Stephen the full schematic of his General Radio 857 tuner oscillator assembly. How back to you, Doug.
Okay, it's an acronym that's for the Boat Anchor Manual Archive, BAMA, Bravo Alpha, Mike Alpha. If you just do a Google search on that, BAMA, it'll come right up for you. I believe it's at a university, maybe it's in Southern California. But yeah, that's the spec on it. The power supply is an 851 Papa. But yes, Western Electric 316 Alpha is the oscillator.
Good information. Okay, so BAMA, B-A-M-A. I'm not familiar with that one. So by that means, Stephen's going to get a full set of schematics and he can make a decision. What's your guess, Doug? Do you think anybody on planet Earth has ever created a direct solid-state equivalent for a Western Electric 316A2? I mean, if there was a FET equivalent, you could completely bypass the filament requirement. That would be great. The 350 volts, though, scares me a little bit. A solid-state equivalent for a 350-volt tube, that's kind of tough. K2JJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, you know, I'm sure it can be done, Dick, but I really don't know of anything. I don't imagine there would be a lot of call for it. You know, as you say, in the Drakes, there were so many of the paid, so many of the facilities, and, you know, there's a demand for somebody to develop a solid-state, you know, plug-in replacement, but kind of doubtful on that one. It's kind of an oddball. Yeah, he can download the whole manual. Print it out, view it, whatever he likes to do. All free of charge, which is the best part.
The price is right. While I've got you, Doug, since you seem to have some familiarity with tube replacement, solid-state replacement for a Drake R4C, I'm slowly coming to the conclusion that the modern-day receivers have lost some of the art they used to have when it comes to really good noise blankers. And I did a rather thorough study 15 years ago of why was the Drake R4C receiver so superior in its noise blanker characteristics. I still own that receiver. I may have a need for really serious noise blanking. Therefore, to keep changing the tubes in that rig as they get gassy is not the right way to go. And if I wanted to plug in the solid-state tube equivalent for a Drake R4C, here we are in the 21st century. My question to you, Doug, is do you think those solid-state equivalent tubes are still available, or am I way beyond the time when they're being produced? K2JJ, K2RIW.
Well, I tell you, Dick, there are guys who make them. I don't know why you'd want to go that route. My experience, I've done a lot of work on Drake, have quite a few of them here. I've almost never found a bad tube in them. I'm going back now, 30 years? With the exception of the finals and the driver, of course, and maybe an output, audio output tube, but, you know, the ones that do the serious heavy lifting, if you will. But as far as, you know, the regular mixers, amplifiers and such, they don't go bad very often. And, they're very commonly available, so I wouldn't break my neck trying to change those out. If you do find them, they're quite expensive.
Okay, and you're probably right. I may be wearing unnecessarily with the tube getting gassy and needing replacement. So I think you're saying the original tubes, on the rare occasion when I might have to replace one of those, I think you're saying they're still available and stop worrying about switching over to solid state. Is that the essentially your assessment, Doug? Go ahead.
Welcome to the W2.
Okay, let the commercial go by. This is KCJJ. Absolutely, Dick. You know, they're all commonly available tubes today. BA6 is very common. You know, your basic 12AX7, dark variety stuff. They're all available for $5-$6 at these tops. So nothing rare in that one.
Okay. Now, let me ask you this question. You're a guy who is had almost everything go across your test bench from time to time. Have you ever twiddled the knob?